This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, website, portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK9 to save 10%. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our new alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 112, A Nephi Beaumont Kind of Thing. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Michael Fisher. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including interesting words about the Star Trek video game from J.J. Abrams, his decision on directing the next film, which engineer would make the best handyman, and our first venture into interstellar space with Voyager 1. Then in the feature, we're joined by Mike Schindler and Max Hegel to discuss the DS9 two-parter, Homefront, and Paradise Lost. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Michael. How are you doing this week? It's great to have you back with me here on The Ready Room. You've been a little bit of a jet setter lately, haven't you?
I have, Chris.
Flying over to Germany and places?
Yes, I've been to Berlin recently, tracking the evolving state of the mobile technology world, and I've just returned. It's nice to be back home, but it was a very fun trip, and we dashed off to Poland for lunch one day, so it was quite the exciting international voyage.
Now, I saw something on Twitter the other day. You did a breakdown of, you were comparing characters to new releases of smartphones, I believe, correct? What was
yeah.
that about?
I have a fair amount of Twitter followers at Captain Two Phones, and I recently got another one who knew how to push my buttons. Because, you know, a lot of people will tweet at me and they'll be like, HTC One or iPhone 5. And I'm like, I have no context for this. I don't know you. I can't make this recommendation. But the crafty ones will look at my profile, know that I'm a Star Trek fan, and go, what phones do you think Kirk and Spock would have used? And I'm like, okay, I will definitely answer this tweet because that's a compelling question nobody has asked me. So yeah. So then I copied, listeners, I copied Chris on that tweet because I thought he would be interested in weighing in. I think I said that Kirk was going to have a, what did I say? One of them had a Galaxy S4 active. That was Kirk, so that he could beat up his communicator and have it still work. And Spock had a Galaxy Note or something for the horsepower, for the computing horsepower.
Yeah. And you used the equal sign, I remember. So I chimed back and I said, and Counselor Troy equals the iPhone 5C because of all her different colored dresses that she wears over the course of the series.
Exactly. Interestingly, I just got done pre-ordering my iPhone 5C to my review unit. So, and it's in cyan. It's in that exact same blue color as my favorite Troy dress. So look at that. You were very timely on that. How are you, Chris? I understand you're battening down the hatches over there and closing isolation doors and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we do. You know, I actually do have the storm shutters closed still in the studio as we record this. A few days ago, this typhoon just suddenly formed in the Pacific, not too far south of Japan. Normally, we see them coming, you know, from further up, but it just kind of came together, started barreling straight towards us here, and is passing over us right now as we record this. I think it may be controlled by the whale probe because it's raining, the cloud cover's dense, and I hear strange noises outside.
You know,
and that was going on all night.
We just gotta find George and Gracie to get them to sing, man. Well, in the meantime, though, I hope that your studio bears up nicely.
But we're hanging in here. You know, we recorded the feature before we recorded the news, and we made it through that. We took a break between segments here. I did see that 3,300 homes in the area have lost power. So we've managed to dodge that here at the Trek FM studios, but hopefully we will get through that. And it does seem that the typhoon is passing over the area here and heading north now. So I think we're going to be in the clear on that.
Excellent. Good.
But as the typhoon leaves the area here, let's look at our first news story, which is about the Voyager 1 spacecraft leaving the area that we call the solar system, heading out into interstellar space. And I think, you know, it's not technically not a Star Trek story, but I think all of us are very excited about the fact that a man-made spacecraft is actually heading out there into the void for the very first time.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's all that the consternation and debate about what constitutes interstellar space versus extrasolar space and when it leaves the bow shock and stuff. And Voyager has already, you know, it's achieved so much in its lifetime, Voyager 1. But it personally, it has resulted in my researching terms and objects that I never knew existed. I didn't know what a bow shock was. And to truth be told, I still don't. I understand it has something to do with radiation patterns at the edge of our solar system. But it's interesting that as the craft leaves our neighborhood, we are continually revising our estimates of where our neighborhood actually ends. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is a nebulous idea. And this was made official last Thursday as we record, September 12th. But they also say that Voyager 1 likely left the solar system on or around August 25th of last year. And they, you know, they've been measuring levels, you know, like you say, of particles of plasma exhaust from our sun and material in the interstellar void to kind of determine when it happens. Because obviously, you know, there's no sign that says, thank you for visiting the Terran system. Hope you come back soon.
Now leaving
President,
the solar sector, yes.
Jarre Shinyo. You know, it doesn't say that anywhere with a little guy waving at you.
Right, come back soon.
It doesn't have that, but it's nearly 12 billion miles from Earth, which is just amazing. And what's even more amazing is to think about the fact that this craft, which has about 1,000 times less memory than the smartphones that we carry in our pockets, was launched on September 5th, 1977, when I was 5 years old, and it's still operating, and it's still out there, and it's still phoning home. It's just an incredible piece of technology.
It really is. It's incredible, and in some ways, it's one of those many examples of how sad it is that our space program is nowhere near as vibrant as it was back in the day. But it also puts me in mind of the producers, or excuse me, the creators of the Star Trek The Motion Picture script and the whole Voyager 6 thing. I wonder more now that I'm reminded of the Voyager spacecraft's existence, whether that was just, I mean, optimism, pure speculation. I don't know what 6 Voyager spacecraft would have accomplished that 2 are not. I've forgotten what the story of Voyager 2 is. It's obviously not as far away as Voyager 1, and it's taking a different path. But what, you know, I don't know what, why 6 of the same type of spacecraft would have been necessary, and I would like to know the story behind that.
Well, I think that it's optimism for the space program more than anything, because, you know, at the time that was written, if you look at things like 2001, A Space Odyssey, you know, we still thought we were going to build these space stations and we were going to have Pan Am flying us back and forth. And, yeah, you know, you could just put your tray table and your seat in the upright position before you docked. And it was going to be like an airline flight. And as for the 6, I think they wanted to pick a number that was something that we probably weren't going to really launch. Like maybe we were going to launch Voyager 3. Maybe we were going to launch a Voyager 4. Mm-hmm. Probably we're not going to launch a 6. So even down the road, when you watch that movie, it's not going to be like the eugenics wars where you say, well, 1991,
well, it's 1996.
That never
happened. I'm fine.
I'm fine. Yeah, no problem there. I think it was a combination, yeah, of optimism and then creatively just wanting to put a little bit of a buffer there so that you weren't going to end up overlapping real technology at any point.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's pretty cool also that in the case of Voyager 1, we can still not optically see it, but we can see it in terms of its radiated radio signal, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's amazing. They're using the Very Long Baseline Array, which is this network that spans from Hawaii all the way to St. Croix. And they use the VLBA to detect the radio signal, as you say, and then you can create an image where you can see the speck from that of where the signal is being radiated. It's just this tiny, tiny little blue dot. You know, as Carl Sagan would describe Earth, a pale blue dot, Voyager is a pale blue dot to us now beyond the edge of our solar system. So it's amazing.
It is amazing. And it's just so fun to look at this 1977 technology, which at the time was, you know, cutting edge. You've got the record and the radioisotope nuclear, you know, reactor power plant, and the big dish that radiates only, what, 22 watts, is it?
22 watts, yeah, like a refrigerator light bulb or a ham radio.
Yeah, and it's just so cool. I love that, you know, it's fun to just look at that in a nostalgic way, but it's also really cool that we put that into space. And not only did it work, but it has continued working for far longer than I think I would have expected had I been around for the launch. So kudos to the Voyager team, you know.
Yeah, most definitely. So we'll see if Voyager 1 ever comes back looking for its maker and, you know, tries to destroy Earth. I don't think it's going to happen, but it just depends on, you know, when they run into the Borg.
That's exactly right.
I've read William Shatner, so we'll see. Well, Michael, if Voyager does come back and it's broken, someone's going to have to fix it. And that leads us to a poll that was on StarTrek.com recently, which asked, which engineer on Star Trek would be the best handyman? And of course, the choices were Scotty, Geordi, O'Brien, B'Elanna, or Tripp. So our five main engineers here. Argyle was not on the list. I don't understand why.
Hugely dispiriting. And what of our friend, Assistant Chief Engineer Shimoda? What about him? Why is he not represented on this list? I mean, come on.
And McDougal? Was that
That's
her name?
Right. McDougal? Yeah, McDougal was her name. Yeah. You ordered me to report to the bridge, sir. Yeah.
Well, and then when she's down there with Riker and they're trying to fix it, and she's like, I'm just going to give up. I mean, I know we're all going to die if I don't solve this, but, you know, I just can't do it. I'm just going to give up.
She gets in his face
with a drink.
These are control chips.
Oh, my goodness. But, okay, so thankfully those guys didn't last too long. And then we got Geordi.
Right.
What do you think? Now, the winner of the poll with 36% was O'Brien.
Yes.
Runner-up was Scotty with 31%. And then it drops way down to 12% who voted for Tripp, 11% voted for Geordi, 9% voted for B'Elanna Torres. What do you think about these results?
I have a couple thoughts on these. One, I am I'm somewhat soured on Star Trek, on polls of the Star Trek community ever since the Las Vegas conflagration of opinion.
Okay.
But this is a StarTrek.com poll. It's about something a little bit less inflammatory. And you know what? I am surprised. For polls like this that ask a question, who'd be the best handyman? You know, that seems like a slam dunk for Scotty. It seems like people would just nail him right there. And, you know, he got close. But I will say that I really agree with O'Brien winning this because, you know, Scotty kept the Enterprise running, and that was great. But the Enterprise was designed to work, and it was designed to exceed its specs. And Scotty did a great job, but he didn't have to go above and beyond too many times to keep the thing from flying apart. O'Brien, on the other hand, is on this rickety Cardassian space station, not built to any specs he's familiar with, and it's constantly getting hit with weapons fire and sabotage and Cardassian tailors blowing up their own shops. So he has to fix a lot of stuff, and that's what I remember most about O'Brien for the first few years of DS9 is him just running around like, I just got the damn thing fixed! And he's got to, you know, tap something else back into place. So absolutely, I love the way this poll turned out. O'Brien would be my handyman of choice. And it's not just because I still watch him every week on Hell on Wheels, because Cole Meany is my favorite. I really, really think O'Brien deserved the win.
I do too. And I agree with you that I was surprised at how this poll turned out, simply because it is a StarTrek.com poll, which means that by default, B'Elanna Torres should have won the poll. Because as we know, Voyager wins almost all StarTrek.com polls.
Right.
But
right.
I think the key to this is the word handyman, because Scotty, yes, he's the miracle worker. But like you said, Scotty was the engineer of a starship designed by Starfleet, designed to work. And yes, problems do crop up with it, but the problems are normally related to the engines themselves, the warp engines of the ship. And that is Scotty's area of expertise. And so you would expect that he would be able to solve the problem. But a handyman is someone who just goes around and fixes things that break, random things that break. And that's exactly what O'Brien does.
Yeah.
You know, O'Brien is working with technology that wasn't designed by Starfleet and that really just breaks for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
And often all he has to work with, well, we've seen where they've got the tubes scattered all over the floor. There's just all kinds of random material that he's working to fix things. And I always picture, although we don't see it, I think that O'Brien has a giant roll of duct tape strapped to his belt at all times.
Absolutely. Space duct tape is what keeps most of DS9 together. I think you're right. And, you know, he even says as much about his role as handyman in Babel. The DS9 episode where everyone's bugging him to fix stuff and he's getting real stressed out and he's like, fix the replicators, Chief. My console's offline, Chief. Should have transferred to a cargo drone. No people, no complaints, he says. And I'm like, yeah, I feel you, O'Brien. But you're a good handyman, so people are going to keep asking you to fix stuff.
Well, compare Chief O'Brien on Deep Space Nine with Joe on News Radio. They're pretty much the same character, right?
Oh, I don't know. I've never watched News Radio. I'm just here
You've
to
never
foil
watched
another
News
comparison.
Radio?
No,
oh,
I know.
I
am in the midst of watching The Newsroom, which I'm loving, by the way. But
okay, well, this is your mission now, Michael. Go watch News Radio, one of the best written sitcoms that was ever on television. Screwed over by NBC back in the day in the 90s because they kept moving it from day to day and time slot to time slot. So you never knew when it was actually going to be on. Mm. Almost the entire cast of that show went on to do other shows that you know very well. Of course, Dave Foley was known for Kids in the Hall. And of course, Phil Hartman, who sadly passed away, was known for Saturday Night Live. Go watch it though. But go watch it and watch Joe. And then tell me if he's not Chief O'Brien working at a news radio station.
I will keep an eye out for that. Thank you.
So I do agree with this. And I also like Trip being third because Trip reminds me a lot of Scotty. Trip for me is sort of like Scotty and Dr. McCoy merged together. He kind of has the personality of Dr. McCoy.
Sure.
But he has the engineering know-how of Scotty.
Yeah. No, I can feel you on that. And I'm actually a little surprised that I'm glad he's third as well. I think that any of these engineers would serve as a good handyman, but it's a question of which ones are going to be better. So you're essentially choosing from the cream of the crop here. And the thing is, I think Trip would be more fun to have around as a handyman. Like, it would seem to me that if I were trying to talk to O'Brien just to, you know, shoot the breeze with him while he was fixing my replicator or my refrigerator, you know, it would be tough to do because he'd be like, I'm busy with this thing. I can't really, you know, I can't talk to you right now. Okay, all right. But Trip would be ready with a joke, some lighthearted observations about paying fried catfish. Yeah. You know,
he'd say, keep
nature.
Your shirt on, Lieutenant.
Exactly right. Yeah, so, you know, I think all of these people are people I would welcome into my house to fix my sink.
Yeah, and I do agree, again, with B'Elanna being last on the list, because although B'Elanna does have that jacket with the Bob the Builder kind of couch on the front where she can keep all of her tools,
right?
She's not the person I would call if I just needed some random thing around the ship or the station repaired.
I'd get worried that she would like try and fix my laptop and like punch it when she got frustrated with it.
Blue screen again? Yeah. Bam!
And then she'd complain about it. Welcome to the worst day of my life. All right.
That's right. All right. So there's the poll, a StarTrek.com poll, not won by Voyager. I am disappointed that Argyle wasn't on here. If the poll had been the engineer who'd make the best bottle of gin is then of course Argyle would have won that.
Absolutely. The best deck 36 moonshine around from Argyle.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next thing here, Michael. Now, this is it's an Into Darkness bit. It's actually not an Into Darkness bit exactly. It's a Star Trek reboot bit about JJ and the fact that he has officially passed on directing the third film in the reboot series. And we were talking about on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Not only this story, but another story that was on StarTrek.com as well. And what are your thoughts on this?
You know, this was inevitable. JJ is going to be busy with Star Wars episode, what is it? It's episode 7. And that makes all the sense in the world to me. You know, JJ has publicly said that now he's much more a fan of Star Trek now than he was when he first started work on the new Star Trek films. But as someone in the cast said, or in the crew, I don't remember whose quote this was, Star Wars has always been his first love. And I think when you get the opportunity to do that, then you lend the reins to somebody else. So I think it's a good thing because he's still going to be producing. He's still going to have creative input. And I think that's a good thing. Now, there are a lot of people who don't think that's a great thing. But, you know, that's wherever you fall in the debate will determine how you feel about this. You know, I think whoever he finds to replace him is going to be quite competent. And I hope maybe it'll be a surprise like the Nick Meyer phenomenon, back when, you know, in Wrath of Khan. Who's this guy? Who's directing this thing? Nick Meyer. I don't know who that is. And then it turned out to be the best rated Star Trek film of, you know, all time.
Mm-hmm. This is where, in the next movie, all the crew members are going to be wearing maroon jackets in the James
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. It's, you know, that's going to be long overdue. It's time to bring the monster maroons back. Yes. What do you feel about it, Chris?
You know, I think that Star Wars is much better suited to JJ than Star Trek is.
Yeah.
So I think that he will make very good Star Wars movies. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of people on Twitter who still scream about this, you know, and some people are like, great, JJ's gone. Now maybe we'll get a good Star Trek film for the next movie. And then I wonder if I feel like fans, they're so focused on JJ that they forget the fact that Orsi and Kurtzman are actually writing the stories. JJ's not writing the scripts for these movies. Now, he may have veto power over something, or he may have creative input. But, you know, if you don't like the stories, the people who wrote the first two stories are coming back to write the next story. So just the fact that JJ's not going to direct, it's not some magic pill that's suddenly going to make this a completely different Star Trek, and you're going to somehow love the third one when you didn't like the first two.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I think it's good to get some fresh blood in at director. I mean, as I told someone yesterday, I don't really care all that much personally because I want Star Trek back on television. These movies, you know, getting 2 hours of Star Trek on the big screen every 4 years is just not really doing it for me. And
I feel you on that. Yeah.
You know, it's not a huge deal to me who directs these movies, who writes them or whatever, because when you look back at Star Trek, if you go 50 years in the future and you look back at Star Trek, these JJ movies are going to be a little footnote in Star Trek because there's just too much other content. And then you've got these three movies. You know, the animated series is a footnote in Star Trek history for most Star Trek fans. And there were 22 episodes of that series. And here we've got three movies. So I think it's something that, you know, fans can get worked up about right now. But in the big picture of Star Trek, it's really not a huge thing. And what JJ's doing, I mean, it has been good for Star Trek. It's bringing in new fans. You know, the Star Trek Origins Blu-ray with Rod introducing the origin stories, as they're calling them, of Pike and Kirk and Khan and Tribbles to new fans, because that disc is clearly designed for people who aren't Star Trek fans, who saw Into Darkness and want to know, okay, well, what's the backstory to these characters?
Right.
I think it's great. You know, it's bringing people in. And so it's been good for that. And JJ doesn't have to direct the third movie for us as a franchise to get that kind of benefit.
I agree. And I was going to make that point. You already made it. I mean, yeah, the long-term effect on Star Trek has been a net benefit. regardless of how you feel, whether the storytelling has added to the cloth, it's brought in a much bigger fan base. And I've talked to some friends of mine who never had watched any Star Trek, and they got done with even Into Darkness, which was not received as well as 09. And then they started rewatching not just Next Generation, which they grew up with, but they started rewatching the original series, or excuse me, they started watching the original series for the first time. And that's happening a lot. And as you say, we now have material that's going to be helping with that, be helping reorient new fans to the universe. I mean, it's great. I love this. So I just hope that whoever they bring in to direct the next one gels well with the cast, with the writing crew, all the crew, because the personal relationships are what's going to make or break the process, I think, I agree with you, Chris. I'd like to see it on TV, but until we're reporting that in this very news section, I guess we have to make do with these movies.
Yeah, and, Into Darkness has been a great success for Star Trek. It's made over $462 million worldwide. And one thing that we have been waiting to see on the Ready Room was, what is it going to do in Japan? Because I was very critical of Paramount's strategy for releasing the movie in Japan. And it has actually done a bit better, and I think a lot of that may be due to Benedict Cumberbatch, actually. But the 2009 movie made a little over $5 million in Japan, and so far Into Darkness has made a little over $9 million in Japan. So it's come close to doubling the take of the 2009 film. And wow. Benedict Cumberbatch is huge here for some reason. And British actors are really big in Japan for some reason.
Well, they're pretty big in America too, so I understand.
Yeah, maybe it's their cool accent. I don't know what it is, but
yes,
I don't know. But it has done better here anyway. Now, whether that will translate to more Star Trek fans in Japan, I don't know. It's always been a struggle here to they try to make Star Trek more popular, and I've been noticing Star Trek series box sets popping up in the DVD shops here in Japan now. I mean, they've been around in the past, but in the past they were like the equivalent of $250 per season.
Jeez. And
over the past few months, I've been seeing them coming in new packaging for about $40, $45 per season. So more like the US prices for DVD, not Blu-ray. So they're trying again. We'll see how it goes. But
yeah.
Any rate, that's the decision. JJ says that he is helping Orci and Kurtzman get the story off the ground for the next film. Mm-hmm. So that he is going to be involved in that. So the directing decision may not have a huge impact on the story itself. It just may influence visually what's going on. It will probably mean no lens flares for those of you who are still really hurt about the lens flares.
Right, yeah, because most of those behind the scenes clips of footage I saw where the lens flare was being introduced, it was JJ personally standing with a big old flashlight right on the edge of the frame.
Well, you know how he does it. We explained this long ago in the Ready Room, is that he actually uses iPads, and he's shaking the iPad by the camera to make the light go. You didn't know that, did you? Side of the iPad. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh right. Fancy.
So, okay, but speaking of being hurt by things, our last news item today is also related to Into Darkness and JJ. And this is, I think, a weird comment that JJ made.
Yeah.
He was talking to a video game publication, Gamer Hub, actually, and he said that he thinks that the Star Trek video game hurt Into Darkness. Now, I just told you that it made $462 million globally in the box office so far. But apparently, JJ feels that it could have made even more money if they had not created that video game to lead into the movie. Do you agree with this, Michael?
No, it's so funny to me because it's like the game was almost invisible to me. Now I'm not a gamer. Okay, so I understand that there are awesome video games and there are bad video games, but I don't know much beyond that. But it was almost completely invisible to me and most of the people that I know. I saw a couple TV spots for it. I saw that it was not terribly well received, But that, to me, has never... Have you ever heard of a correlative relationship between the quality of a video game tie-in to ticket sales on the related film? Because I think that's a bit of a stretch.
Right, exactly. I think there are a couple of things here. You made one of the points I was going to make, which is that you said you're not a gamer and the game was pretty much invisible to you. I think that for 95% anyway, of the tickets sold for this film in the box office, those people didn't play the video game or even knew that the video game existed, other than maybe they saw a commercial for it on television, but they didn't really think about it afterwards. And the other thing is that anyone who is a gamer knows that movie tie-in video games suck in general. They are rarely good. It's just when you know that a video game is tying into a movie, you pretty much assume as a gamer that it's not going to be great, that it's just part of the marketing scheme for the movie. Now, they did something a little bit different with this one, which is that as they were doing with the comics, both the ongoing comics going all the way back to issue one and Countdown to Darkness, they did put some elements in the game to kind of help lead you in towards the movie because all this stuff is coming together. But it's nothing that you need to know in order to enjoy the movie. And, you know, it pretty much is a marketing thing. And
yeah. Now, is this?
I don't think it has any impact on the success of the movie at the box office at all.
Definitely not. And that point that you were making is echoed in this quote. I don't know if it's from JJ here that we're very rarely
JJ.
Does. Okay, so yeah. He says very rarely does a movie based on a game or a game based on a movie really work. Yeah, and that's true. Now, I'm relieved that I now don't have to feel compelled to go try it out. I don't know what your feelings, Chris, are on Star Trek Online, but I've seen very few titles bearing the Star Trek brand name in terms of gaming that I've really wanted to try in the last probably decade. And I may be exaggerating a little bit there, but I remember games like Star Trek Judgment Rights back in 93. Just blew me away. I mean, that is what a Star Trek game should be. There should be, if there are puzzles, they should be logical and easy to solve if you apply the tenets of Star Trek to it. You should be scored based on your adherence to Starfleet principles if you happen to be playing on the Starfleet side. It should be an intelligent game. It should be a nicely balanced cocktail of action and adventure and thoughtfulness. And it should have a great soundtrack, and you should get the actors to do the voices. Like, that's perfect. Like, I understand that's a lot to get into one game, and that's why we love this game because it was a classic. But it can't be that hard to do that the last game of that quality, you know, the last few games of that quality were over 15 years ago now. Because what were some of the other ones? Like, Borg was around back then.
The Borg games. We had that.
I don't know if that was any good or not. I just saw that one.
It was, I mean, it was simplistic, but it was pretty good at the time for Star Trek fans, I think. But I think that, now, they did get the voices to go into this game, which is good. But the problem for me is that exactly what you said a Star Trek game should be, that's what Star Trek fans, I think, want in a video game based on Star Trek for it to really be successful. And what you got here largely was a first-person shooter. And I'm not a fan of first-person shooters. You know, I don't want to run around and shoot things. And if I do, you know, I'll get a game like Resistance or something like that, which is it's blatantly a first-person shooting game, not a Star Trek game, not a first-person shooter disguised as a Star Trek game.
Exactly. And I will reinforce your point because I like first-person shooters. I have a great time with them. I would never want a first-person shooter Star Trek game. It just doesn't. They do not complement each other. Those worlds should not work together.
And the thing about Star Trek Online, now I have an account. I have a ship. I rarely ever go into it because I just don't have time for it. I love the idea of Star Trek Online. I wish it had come around like a decade earlier because it's exactly the kind of game that I always wanted. And then when we finally got it, I was at a point in life where I can't play it because I have too many other responsibilities and such to do. But a lot of people play Star Trek Online, though, for the battles. And that's something that I'm not so interested in. You know, I don't want to just go in and build up a ship and go in and have space battles. So what they'd have in Star Trek Online, for those who don't want to do that, is they do have diplomatic missions. They do have missions where you do and you go and you uphold the principles of the Federation and you try to negotiate and you try to be more like a Picard as opposed to, you know, a JJ style space battle thing. And so that's nice. And so I think there is good stuff in Star Trek Online for fans. Regardless of what you want out of your Star Trek game, you can get it there. But this particular game wasn't really that. It was pretty much, it was a game that you could have produced and just taken the Star Trek clothing off the characters and you could have still had the game and, you know, replaced the Gorn with regular dinosaurs because the Gorn in this game pretty much look like dinosaurs that are going to, they're like Godzilla from the Godzilla remake of, was that 98, I believe? Yeah.
Now, if I can interject briefly with a while we're talking about gaming, do you know what I just played last night, Chris?
Leisure Suit Larry.
No, Leather Goddesses of Phobos. No. I played a game, and I don't know if I've talked about this on the air before, but I might have, called Artemis, the Artemis Bridge, Starship Bridge Simulator. Yeah. Well, we...
Oh, yeah. I know that, yeah.
Yeah. We've gotten to a point now with my group of friends where we have actually managed to cobble together 10 or 11 hardcore nerds, and we will about once a month play this game. And if you're not familiar with it, it's a bridge simulator. So you sit in the room, you have the view screen set up on a server computer, and everyone else has a tablet or a computer that represents one bridge station. So somebody's communications, somebody's science, somebody's engineering, somebody's, of course, the captain, there's a weapons officer, a helmsman, and all of these stations work together to maneuver or otherwise affect the behavior of the ship on the screen. And we had enough people last night when I played that we had a separate ship down the hall in my kitchen, which was an entirely separate bridge staffed by a different group of friends, and the two ships worked together. This game was coded by one guy, and it's been in development for years. And I tell you, it is so much fun. If you can get a couple computers together and a couple friends together and play this game, it's called Artemis. And it sounds like a plug, but we're not getting paid for this promo. It's just that I've been having so much fun playing this game. So, Chris, you've got to when you make a pilgrimage to the States, I got to have you over, and you can join the crew of the Artemis.
Okay, that sounds like fun. Yeah, I've seen some videos on YouTube, I believe, of people playing that.
It's pretty amazing. And when you have two ships, you can do fun things like have an always open ship-to-ship frequency. I had an earbud in my ear the whole night talking to the other ship and coordinating our efforts.
Now if I get a group together and I create a Klingon ship and I approach and we hail you guys and we speak Klingon to you, will you pull out the giant dictionaries and start flipping through so that you can communicate with us?
You know, our communications officer are well-versed in all the dialects of Klingon, so I don't think we'll need to get out the Klingon dictionary this time.
Okay, great. And also, your communications officer can tell the difference between the Vulcan language and the Romulan language, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, even when we're condemning food, things, and supplies, yes.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so in the end here, I don't even know why JJ would bring this up. You know, he mentions that they were involved at the beginning. They were not happy with the way it was going, so they got out of it, and Namco Bandai and Paramount continued to develop the game despite that's his quote. And it just sounds like sour grapes, and I don't think this had any impact whatsoever on the success of Into Darkness at the box office. So I don't know why he even brought this up, but I did want to talk about it just from a video game perspective, because it's kind of interesting the way that Star Trek does branch out into different mediums now with the video games and the comics and the movies, and especially how Bad Robot tries to tie all that stuff together, whether it's Star Trek or other things they do. And then to hear him say this about something like that it just surprised me a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, Michael. Well, that is everything that we have in news today. But before we jump into our feature about Homefront and Paradise Lost, let's take a moment and tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace. Now, your sponsor of Squarespace is very important for making it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you. And what they are is they are an all-in-one platform that combines your web hosting and your content management into one package, and it makes it really, really simple for you to create your own online space. And it could be a blog, it could be a large website, or a portfolio if you're a designer or a musician. It could be an online store. They have a commerce feature that allows you to accept credit cards and, you know, easily process orders, handle shipping and taxes and such. And I use Squarespace myself. I've used them for about 6 years. Trek FM is built on Squarespace. The tools are really fantastic. And another thing I love about them is that they are continually improving the platform. They're adding new features. They're adding new designs. They're always improving their support. I just had an experience with their support a couple of weeks ago. It was fantastic. They went way out of their way to help me. I was very, very satisfied with it. And the best thing of all is it starts at just $8 a month, and you can get a free custom domain registration if you choose the annual plan. And there are really three key things that I love about Squarespace. Michael, can you tell us about a few of those?
Yeah. The first is that Squarespace is design focused. So they actually care about design. As a design guy, as a person who values aesthetics, I can get behind that. All their templates are extremely clean. And they allow your content to be the focus of your website. And people visit your website for the content, so that works out pretty nicely. And there's also connected accounts. You can connect your Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Instagram, Google, many more web and social services. Not any, but effectively any if you're talking about
the major
players.
Most all the major ones are there.
Exactly. Yeah, the major players. And finally, aesthetics and social integration are nothing without responsiveness. So every Squarespace website has its own unique mobile design. So your site will scale to look beautiful on every device, regardless of the screen size, which is smart and I think awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. What I love about websites that are very wide, for example, that are Squarespace sites and you've got sidebars on them. Mm-hmm. If you try to cram that into a small, like an iPhone screen, it's really hard to see, right? But what it does is it automatically takes that sidebar and it slides it up underneath the main content body. So it creates a very vertical page. So you don't lose your content and it's formatted very nicely. And what they do also say for menus is instead of having the menu system with little links across the top, they'll actually give you a little button that you press on the screen and that pulls up the menu in a very clean format. So then you can jump to each section in the website. So it's very
more and
nice.
More people on mobile devices, this is all much more relevant.
Yeah, it really makes it much easier to take in the content on a Squarespace site. And the commerce feature that we mentioned is really fantastic. They use Stripe. You pay a small fee to Stripe for processing credit cards, just like you would to any system where you process credit cards, just like any retail shop does as well. Mm-hmm. And you don't pay anything to Squarespace. And that feature is just $24 a month. And you get it all in one, so you don't have to go set up your separate, like Google Checkout, that kind of stuff, where you start having to pay different entities. So that is a really fantastic feature as well. But, the best way to find out how all this works is just to go try it for yourself. And you can try it free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. You just enter your name and your email address. You'll have a temporary site set up instantly for you. And that site actually gives you access to all the tools in Squarespace. And, you can try those out. If you've already got your site on a system like WordPress, you can import your site in there and then start modifying it with the tools so that you can see how the tools give you everything that you need to create an exceptional website. And then, I already mentioned $8 for the basic package, $24 for the commerce. In the middle for $16, there's the unlimited package, which gives you unlimited pages, unlimited bandwidth, really unlimited everything. That's the most popular option. It's one that I use, and it's very, very inexpensive if you think about going out and trying to do all this stuff on your own with hosting and a CMS. And another great thing is that if you choose the annual plan, you'll get a free custom domain registration. So you can get captain2phones.com and you can get on there and you can do all your comparisons of Star Trek characters and smartphones. Which is which. I want to know who Cisco is in the smartphone world.
Oh, Cisco and smartphone. Well, sonorous, but, gentle, effective, but massive. So, just in the absence of anything else, I'm going to have to say Cisco would be something weird, like the Acer Liquid S2. Look it up. It's pretty awesome looking phone. It's a beast.
Also, for those who still use BlackBerries with the keyboard down at the bottom, who's that in the Star Trek universe?
Oh, man, that's like Barclay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's Barclay.
Yeah, the BlackBerries are smartphones for Lieutenant Broccoli's. Yes. Actually, it's funny. I have one right next to me here, and I have the Q10, and it's just lovely. It looks great.
Well, we're looking forward to that website, Captain2Phones.com,
absolutely,
on Squarespace, comparing Star Trek characters and smartphones. And so, Michael, would you sign up for that? Be sure to use offer code TREK9 when you sign up. You'll get 10% off your lifetime purchase on that new account. Mm-hmm. And you can do all that by just going to squarespace.com, get the 14-day free trial, then use offer code TREK9 to get 10% off. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of the Ready Room and Trek FM. And we thank you for supporting Squarespace and helping us bring this programming to you every week. The addition of Worf to Deep Space Nine forced the writers to make some adjustments to the planned course of the show, and a big one was the planned third season cliffhanger Homefront. The threat of changelings on Earth would have lingered over the summer, and season 4 would have kicked off with Paradise Lost, but instead, the two-parter got scaled back and moved about a third of the way into the season. But it was still an effective story, and today we're going to talk about these episodes with the help of our commentary Trek Stars team of Mike Schindler and Max Hegel. Hey guys, how are you guys doing? It's been a long time no see for us.
Yeah, it's good to see you again. How is the weather over there in Japan?
Oh yes, we are recording this show under the threat of typhoon. The typhoon is going to hit the Trek FM studios here sometime within the hour, so we'll see how that goes. I've got the storm shutters closed. I'm all set. I'm ready to do a barrel roll if necessary to get to safety during the show.
Do you have one of those suction cup things to put on your windows?
I do, yes. Oh. It's actually cool. It's an attachment to our vacuum. So we just put it right on the nozzle and slap it on the window.
Yeah. Get him back. Get him back.
But you only have one for just one window?
Just one, yeah.
I'm pretty sure they're intended to break windows.
Oh, okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I have to ask you guys, what is the estimated cloud cover of the planet right now?
I believe it's 78.8% last I checked. Last I checked with the large-headed dude.
All right. And of course, I say long time no see, Mike and Max, because we just recorded a show together a few days ago talking about Ronald D. Moore, who plays a role in what we're going to talk about today as the writer of Paradise Lost.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that'll drop on Friday.
Oh, sweet.
It will. All right. Very good. Okay. So, well, let's just jump into the story here. And as I mentioned, this was originally intended to be the cliffhanger at the end of season 3, but then the studio decided to bring Worf over. We got Way of the Warrior. It caused a little bit of course adjustment for the show. And I think the biggest impact that it probably had on this was the fact that the budget for this story got significantly cut. In addition to the fact that the story got pushed out of the spotlight as a cliffhanger into the first third of the season during a time that Robert Hewitt Wolf calls in the middle of nowhere, because the studio doesn't like them to do two-parters early in the season, you know, coming off of a cliffhanger. And so they couldn't do it in sweeps either. And so it just kind of got pushed there into the middle of the season a bit. But what did you guys think about this episode? Max, what were your initial thoughts about the story?
Well, as a two-parter, I'm very frustrated by it, because the first part is essentially just one giant political red herring. And as a viewer, I caught on to that within the first act, And I was sort of ready for them to have the realization that they were going down the wrong track, cutting down on, you know, personal freedoms and liberties and such in order to capture the bad guys, because I understood the political subtext, I think, as fast as most people did. But as if it was a cliffhanger, I would have expected some sort of resolution to that, and I would have been incredibly frustrated if I spent all summer thinking, are we just waiting for them to come back from the break and say, we shouldn't have done that. That was bad.
Well, but that's not what it was going to be. It was going to.
It still had that element.
It was going to open with this story. So, like episode.
Oh, so
part,
it wasn't.
Part
it wasn't
would
supposed
have been
to
the
be
season
the finale?
Premiere. No, no.
Oh well, that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine then.
Okay.
Either way, I still don't like the first part of this story because it doesn't go anywhere, and that would be fine if it didn't go anywhere, but then it's like part one of two. And then like the second part is like a completely different thing. As you know, the political subtext is fine. It's just, why make it a two-parter?
If they had done it as a cliffhanger, I think that the overall scope of the story would have been a bit bigger than it is here. And one element that they had originally planned was that there were more than four changelings on Earth, and they had infiltrated the human population, and they had thrown the Federation onto the verge of civil war. And there was a conflict between Earth and Vulcan, and a Federation starship was going to fire on a Vulcan transport in Earth orbit. And there would have been, I think, a bit more to it than what we got in Homefront if they had followed their original plan. Now, I don't know if they would have followed that storyline exactly, because they did decide that the Vulcan angle wasn't quite telling the story that they wanted to tell. And that's how they got into the internal coup with Starfleet trying to overthrow the Federation with a military coup. But I think some other elements might have come in.
I also lament the loss of the United Earth element. That was a reasonable thing, having an Earth government and the Federation superseding the Earth government in a time of crisis. That makes a lot of sense. By streamlining the story, it sort of seems overly simple that the Federation just runs Earth.
It does. Yeah, that threw me for a loop as well. I was a little bit frustrated with the streamlining, as you say, as well. I think that's kind of a product of the way DS9 still was. This is still not, in my opinion, the great show that DS9 was to become. I know it's season four, but this is still kind of embryonic, the early stages of DS9 kind of pushing out. I think this is the first time in Star Trek we see a show that is a legit two-parter with two different episode names, right? I might be wrong on that, but it's one of the first times.
I think they already
have. Yeah, I mean, you have the Circle Trilogy at the beginning of season two.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I think you also, didn't you also have the Die is Cast and the Die is Cast part
Inferno's
two?
Light.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. All right. Then that maybe that was a bad example. But, you know, it's still – both of those shows were DS9 examples. So the show is still taking the opportunity to kind of push the format and reach toward that, you know, that weekly – to the serial format. So, you know, I appreciated that. And I wasn't necessarily disappointed. The facile elements kind of catch my attention first. And overall, I was like, well, why is it that – why is it that Layton, the admiral, who I guess we're going to talk about in a minute, hasn't really thought this out beyond Earth? Because, yeah, it would have been nice to see the structures of the geopolitical machinations of what was happening on Earth. But also he's dedicated no thought to what's going to happen once this coup, if it gets off the ground, what's going to happen to it when it reaches the rest of the Federation. Sisko's counterargument is just perfect. It's like, what if those other worlds aren't behind this? And his response is basically, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. And I don't know. It seemed like a really half-baked plot to me, if that makes sense.
I agree. I think that the plot is not only like not completely thought out, that gap in the thinking process reveals a fundamental flaw of the argument of the episode, being that if that theory is right, and that actually is what's going on, that the changelings have infiltrated as many levels of the structures as they've imagined as possible, then they really should probably do all of this incredibly oppressive cutting down on personal liberties thing, because that might mean the end of everything.
That's a solid plan, because it's hard to argue with Sisko's initial counterargument to his father, which is, you know, what I'd rather have I'd rather have Starfleet in the streets with phaser rifles than Jem'Hadar in the streets.
Yeah, it's not great, no matter how you slice it, but if nobody slices it, it'll turn into your dad and kill you in your sleep.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I think that ultimately what they're going for is just the idea that when there's an external threat, you know, whatever those people are doing to us, we're doing something much worse to ourselves, because it's about paranoia. Mm-hmm. That's what Wolf talks about, that ultimately paranoia is the end, is what he said about this episode. And for me, it's interesting how DS9 so often foreshadowed our own world, where this episode is a perfect example of what the United States has become after the 9/11 attacks. But this was, of course, written 6 years before that. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't hard to, you know, anticipate these types of threats. They weren't new before 9/11, but the nature of terrorism has changed significantly from what we grew up with in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and before to what it is now. You know, and now it's to the point where the threat that terrorists present to us is tiny compared to what we're doing to destroy our own society through, you know, a crackdown on civil liberties and rights. And, you know, now you've got the government just spying on you without any oversight. And that's what Layton is trying to set up here on Earth in this story. And so they can go different ways with the story. You know, is their ultimate point simply to talk about how we harm ourselves when we become paranoid of threats? Or is it the storyline of the coup on Earth branching out into the Federation and what would happen to the Federation as a whole? Because, you know, one is a single society, or they can branch out into the broader Star Trek picture, kind of in-universe picture here. And I feel like they were just really focused primarily on that rights issue more than anything. And so they did create, as you say, a rather simplistic storyline.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with the political argument. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that when you, in a way, the budget might have been a problem, because when you simplify it down to the point where the counter argument makes more logical sense, you kind of hurt your own point.
Right. And, you know, they pay a bit of lip service to that, to the when, you know, we have the argument between Sisko and his father about the blood screenings. And then, you know, Sisko's father is adamantly against it. And he has some wonderful quotes in there about, you know, you should not force people to constantly prove they are who they say they are. It's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong. And then I believe it's in the next episode where he's happily complying with the blood screening, and he and Sisko are having the talk over lunch, and he's like, "Well, that was before, and now, you know, that was before we lost power for 2 days. So Earth loses power for a while, and Joseph Sisko turns around this whole thing." And normally I would criticize that as something that's an example of lack of continuity of character, but no, it makes perfect sense, because people really are that fickle, you know, people really are that easily unsettled. And so I found that to be really, really interesting. For all these other arguments aside, it's like, how much does it take ultimately for you to violate your principles and say, "Yeah, no, I'm fine with this. A little more security is okay." You know, that was a scary moment to me. And I don't know if it was intended as that, but it was.
One of the things that I like about that whole argument and the way that it's presented in the episode is that the main characters, you know, Sisko and Odo and everybody, they're taking this one side, and you've got, you know, a supporting character, someone who we've never actually seen before, Sisko's dad, taking the other side. And I think, you know, if you were to ask the writers, they'd probably say that the supporting character was the one who was right. I mean, obviously, it's a much more complicated issue, but, you know, at least the way that it's presented, I really got the impression that, you know, on any other Star Trek show, it's like, can Picard ever be wrong? You know, no,
sure.
It's always the crew telling the dumb native people why they're wrong, you know,
sure.
And here it's kind of the opposite. And I thought that was pretty cool, but it also, I think, worked sort of dramatically as someone who, you know, like I was 15 when this thing came on, you know, and having watched, you know, Star Trek basically nonstop for like 3 years, I was in that mindset of course, the Federation is always right. And then here, you know, it sort of made me question that. Which I think was cool.
I think that's because the Deep Space Nine writers were in many ways wiser than they were smart. And this episode is definitely more wise than it is effective. Its flaws reveal the fundamental, like, you know, problem of thinking the problem through all the way, but it comes from a wise place of questioning your own intentions, which is something that almost everyone in every field has a problem with. And that Star Trek occasionally dealt with it is pretty bold. They certainly dealt with it in the movies. I mean, Six, which this episode rips a lot of actors from. they were certainly onto that mode there. Certainly Nicholas Meyer was on that particular game for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mike, you mentioned Joseph here, and I think that the whole relationship with Sisko and his dad, for me, helped this story along, because one thing we feel like they know each other. It's when you watch this episode now, after you've watched Deep Space Nine many, many times, and you're accustomed to the relationship that Benjamin Sisko has with his father, you see this episode a little bit differently, I think, because Avery Brooks and Brock Peters played together so well here, I feel. And part of that could be that they actually wrote two paragraph dossier of Joseph Sisko in the script to set up the character. And that gives the whole background of his life, and that he had fought this battle, debilitating battle against a disease, and that has started to catch up with him. And that's, you know, that sets up why he's having the health problems that he's having at this point, and why he feels like he's running out of time, you know, something he talks to Jake about. I think that helped Brock Peters play the character much more effectively, and also Avery to play off of it. But in addition to that, you have the unique thing you have here, I think, is what you're talking about, Mike, is that, you know, Sisko's arguing from the military side. You know, he doesn't agree with Layton, so internally the military is at odds with itself. But Joseph gives us something that we don't normally get in these stories, which is he's us. You know, he's the civilian, and he is giving you the civilian's point of view of what Starfleet's doing and what's happening on Earth. Because, again, Max, like you said, can Picard ever be wrong? That's because we're always on a Federation starship, and we're only seeing things from our side. We're only seeing it through the military personnel. We don't really get to see a civilian point of view. So I think that works well with Joseph and Benjamin here, not only being civilian and military, but also being father and son. And you can tell that they have a close father and son relationship as well. And so they can examine the situation, the realities of it, you know, doing things that must be done versus doing things that you don't think you should have to do because you think it's your civil liberty that you shouldn't have to take these blood tests. They can examine it from a family perspective as well, in a deeper relationship than two other characters would be able to.
Yeah. I mean, it's the equivalent of a really, really likable character having a son or a daughter go into the TSA in the United States and, you know, be trying to fly on a flight and getting the pat down. Like, it's a lot of these, and Chris, you've mentioned this before, but I love also how DS9 is able to sort of be interesting and predict the future a bit. And so many of these arguments against the things like the blood screenings and the phaser sweeps are so reminiscent of security in today's world. And they all come from, almost all of them come from Joseph Sisko's mouth. And they're delivered so wonderfully by Brock Peters that you can't help but sympathize with him. Of course, you're supposed to, but I don't know. I felt less like selling out than I thought I would. I'm like, yes, I understand what you're trying to get me to associate with writers. Thank you. But when it's coming from Brock Peters, I'm like, yeah, no, this makes all the sense in the world. I too would be angry, you know.
Yeah.
One thing about the relationship, did it bother anyone else? I mean, at no point early on in the show
how much shorter he is than everyone else.
No, at no point.
It's a little weird.
And at no point in the show do they say, you know, oh, Sisko's dad is dead. But the way that he talks about his dad early on in the series is like he's dead. Like, my dad used to be a chef, you know?
Yes.
And then all of a sudden they were like, oh, no, wait, he's alive, you know, which is fine, but...
I don't know. I mean, that's just, you know, that goes on in writing before you.
Yeah, that happened in Frasier, right? Frasier's dad was dead on Cheers, and then suddenly Frasier gets a show, and his dad's not dead at all. They actually
he's not dead.
That.
He just has a bad hip. That's all.
Yeah. They had a falling out, and he was for a while dead to him.
Right. Yes. He was dead to me for a bit. No, I was not as annoyed by that as I was by the fact that Sisko's sister was referenced a couple times. In one of these, and I was like, "Am I just forgetting Sisko's sister in the rest of the continuity, or what?" Correct me if I'm wrong. Am I forgetting Sisko's sister angle in the rest of the series?
I don't remember.
Think so
at all.
No,
no.
She just she doesn't have much to do with the family. She never comes home for Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
you know,
she doesn't care when he turns into a prophet. That's cool.
She doesn't like jambalaya gumbo. So
she's the outcast.
Much to do with her.
Yeah.
I empathize with that. None of their food looks good to me.
Oh man, that food that got me to eat order some jambalaya today. I know they were eating gumbo, but I was like, well, jambalaya is the best I can get on short notice. That's what I'm gonna have. Whenever I see people eating on Star Trek, I have to eat. Isn't it?
It is very fun to say.
It's like Hasparat. It always makes me want burritos.
Yeah.
Jambalaya.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. But the other thing I like about seeing Sisko with his father here is that I can see how his relationship with his father is passed down to Jake, the relationship that Sisko has with Jake, the way that they interact as father and son. You know, you just see, you have families where, you know, the parents and the children have good relationships and they're very close and they've grown up through generations, kind of a loving family. And then you, on the other side, you have families where everyone's fighting all the time and everyone's at odds with one another. No one speaks to each other. And then, you know, when those people have children, that can create a sort of an uncomfortable relationship that's passed on because you don't know how to express that to your children, you know, to pass down what you've learned. And Sisko's relationship with Jake, and you know, and Jake didn't really work out very well as a character on DS9. I think most people would agree on that.
Yeah.
But I did like the fact that they gave the captain a family, gave him a son on the show, because you've seen Picard, who doesn't want to make an ass of himself in front of children because he doesn't like children. You've got Riker, who, you know, can't get along with his father. It's nice that in DS9, they actually gave the captain a son and they made it a caring relationship. And then here you can see that he had the same relationship with his own father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. That's nice to see.
In some ways, it feels more like a response to the absence of familial relationships and the one or two times that they introduce a family member. It's to say, oh, he died. So.
Yeah.
I think it makes sense to have at least, you know, some element of let's just do something different for the sake of doing something different. And I think they actually discovered something really useful by doing something just different. Because,
right.
I don't have a problem with Jake. I think he's a great character. I think that he spends way too much time looking at women. It's a little creepy. But I thought he was perfectly useful.
I think it was useful on the page. Yeah, I think the execution of Jake was not my favorite on the series. But I'm sorry, Mike, I talked over you there.
That was okay. I was just going to say, but here they explain, you know, sort of the lineage of him looking at women, because it seems like his grandpa was a really
his
big...
His grandpa's a perv. Yeah. His grandpa's just like,
only
oh.
Three times you should be in bed.
Yeah.
One of them with a beautiful woman.
Here, have some space condoms.
do they have a blade of armor on them?
It's context sensitive. It's whatever you need it to have, it becomes that.
Right.
Nanotechnology. God, that sounds horrifying.
Nanotechnology ablative condoms. We've gone to a fun place.
This is where Bentine will phone back and say, someone has equipped the space condom with a blade of armor and neglected to inform Starfleet.
Neglected to inform us.
Neglected to inform the citizens of the Federation.
This was the first time watching it. Yesterday was the first time that I picked up on the fact that that was Leah Brahms. I'm slow.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
See, that bothers me.
On my first viewing, I didn't see it. I took my second or third viewing to finally like be like, oh, wow. But that, yeah.
Yeah.
Why does that bother you, Max?
Because that kind of thing happens in Star Trek all the time. And every time it happens, I get a little bit more annoyed by it.
It happens three times in this episode alone.
This episode has it a bunch of places. But like the ones that really bother me are like that, like the Vulcan lady from like season two appearing as Worf's girlfriend and then disappearing and then reappearing as Susie a Q. Paxton,
yeah.
And it's like, come on. Yeah.
And then she's an Andorian on Enterprise.
That's too many things. She's not Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
I don't mind that so much. I like that they did it with Brock Peters here because Admiral Cartwright was always my favorite. So it was great to see him in something else where he could actually be something else and maybe redeem his name a little bit after the Cartwright incident.
Well, let me ask you this.
Is that what it's called? Is it called the Cartwright incident?
That's what it's called Cartwright in my incident. Household. We only talk about it very often.
Let me ask you this, Max. Would this have bothered you? Now, Susan Gibney was actually one of the leading candidates for the role of Captain Janeway on Voyager.
Being bothered by that sounds like pre-Cartwright incident thinking to me, so I'm going to say no.
Okay.
Very forward-thinking of you. Good. Mm-hmm. Good.
That's good. Well, let's talk a little bit about Red Squad, because this is, like Section 31, this is one of those things that was created in DS9 that's been used a bit afterwards. At least Red Squad's been used in the comics a good bit. Oh. It was used in the setup of Into Darkness in the Countdown to Darkness comics. Also in the After Darkness comics, they've picked up on Red Squad. Yet again, we get it later in DS9 where we have I think is a somewhat ridiculous storyline of a ship full of cadets fighting behind the lines in the Dominion War.
On a Defiant class vessel for some reason.
But it was okay because it had that great line that made it all worthwhile. Where they're like, that's the Valiant. And then Sisko's like, or Ben Jake is like, that's a great name.
Yeah.
Which is a joke that no one aside from the writing staff would get. But
no, people who read the DS9 companion get it.
Exactly.
And then when they watch that episode, they're like, that's a little inside, you guys.
That joke. That makes that whole episode worthwhile.
I don't know if anything can make up for that episode's lunar scooter bit and, cadet chiefs. And anyway, did we talk about that episode?
We have not talked about that episode. And we probably won't
Let's get loaded on Romulan ale and talk about that episode.
Let's burn that bridge when we get to it.
Yeah, good idea. Anyway, Red Squad. So yeah, I have a question now. This has always confused me because I was similarly confused about Section 31 for a while and then I got unconfused, but was Red Squad specifically created, not by the writing staff, but in-universe, was Red Squad created by these instruments of coup d'etat, or was it something that was just kind of an instrument that was utilized for that purpose? It had already existed. Because Sisko had never heard of it, right? We know it's a new organization, a new subset of the Academy.
I think the implication is that it's been around for a while because everyone else seems like, oh yeah, Red Squad. Bunch of flashy jerks walking around wearing their red letter jackets.
Yeah, but Nog is like, no, it's Sisko's like, I don't remember anything about that. And Nog's like, it's new. It's a team of elite cadets. And it's like, okay. Yeah. So new relative to when Sisko graduated can be any time in the past little while, right?
Yeah.
But was it specifically created as a component of this attempted overthrow or –
I would say no. It sounds like this was just a thing that was created, you know, for whatever reason, and you know, it was utilized by these evil forces.
Evil?
Whatever. You know what I mean. I was exaggerating. to do.
Well, I think that what it could be is that it's been around, but it's something that's quiet like Section 31 is quiet. And they're now the writers were trying to throw you off track. That's what they say. Of course, they didn't succeed in throwing Max off track. He saw right through them.
I don't think they succeeded in throwing anyone, you know, over 13 off track.
But what they say about Nog and Red Squad is that, you know, they were trying to set up just the idea that Nog is encountering prejudice at the Academy, being the first Ferengi at the Academy, and he's wanting to get in and be popular, and he wants people to like him, and so he wants to be in this Red Squad unit. But the other thing that they suggest, again, to make you wonder who's a changeling, who's behind this, where are the changelings, is that when Sisko sits down and he has that conversation with Nog, where he's trying to get the name of someone in Red Squad, Nog makes him think by what he says that Red Squad itself could perhaps be changelings. And then it also makes you wonder, did they suggest to Nog that he could get into Red Squad to use Nog as a way to get to Sisko? You know, was Leighton behind that somehow? Or was that Bolian, who talks way too much, which lets you know why Bolians are barbers on starships, because they just love to talk, apparently, and they're really loose with information.
They don't bother looking around the side of the frame on a space Skype call, yeah.
That's right. were they, you know, using Nog as a way to kind of get to Sisko, and that's how they leaked the existence of Red Squad to Nog so that they could then get to Sisko? You know, I don't know.
Oh my God, you could write a Lecare novel about this.
Yeah.
You have really thought about this. Because
ultimately, isn't it Sisko's discovery of Red Squad, like, key to his undermining the whole thing and unraveling the whole thing? I think that
was... Yeah.
So,
my impression, I don't think it's nearly that complex. I think Red Squad is something which was created for the, you know, honors cadets, whatever. And, you know, Nog wanted to get into Red Squad just because he wanted to get into Red Squad. Red Squad admired Sisko just because he was the head of Starfleet or whatever it was at that point in time. And, you
Internal
know, this,
security.
Yeah. And this admiral, this evil admiral.
Evil?
Whatever. Utilized.
Sure, God, you should work for Bush in the past.
he utilized Red Squad because he knew that they were skilled and yet young and naive and stupid and would do whatever he wanted them to do and not even ask questions.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. So I can get behind that. It just seems to me that the whole conceit behind Red Squad is – antithetical to Starfleet's, you know, whole thrust of equality. And yeah, it's a meritocracy to a degree, but an elite team of cadets who get all these cool training missions and special things going on. Like,
but they've already done that, essentially. Yeah. I mean, wasn't Wesley in – what was that one called?
Right.
That was a Nova Squadron. That was a flight team, though.
That's the same thing.
Yeah, but that's not the same thing. It's like a drill team, and it's like an extracurricular activity. It's not
still,
like
but they get to fly dope spaceships around Mars.
Well, it's true, but I'm sure there's a swim team, too, where you get to swim in a like low-gravity pool on like Titan.
And I bet they get lots of swim team groupies. There are lots of perks to being in any team.
I wanted to go to Starfleet Academy. I just wish I'd been able to get in.
Well, you know who was the head of swim team when he was at the Academy? That would have been Commander Flipper from Cetacean Ops.
Oh, that's right. Yes, later reassigned to the Enterprise D's navigation section. Right, right.
He set all the speed records for the swim teams at the Academy.
His combat just wouldn't stay on him.
Man, no, that is a dope reference. We got to make an award for reference.
I mean, what is that a reference to? Is that a reference to them saying that there was a dolphin on
yesterday's Enterprise?
Yesterday's Enterprise when they call people to Cetacean Ops.
Okay, all right. Okay, sorry, I'm not that.
That was an elite level reference. You could get on the Red Squad with a reference like that.
That's right. Reference Squad.
Yeah.
I want to get on Reference Squad. It's an elite group of cadets that make references to
we
other
wear
things
red jackets that have incredibly detailed, meticulous, obscure references to single lines of dialogue in one random episode of a Next Generation episode.
Woven right into the fabric.
It's great. Oh, yeah. Each one has a unique reference.
But it was – okay, so – You guys talked about Red Squad being naive and they'll just do whatever they're told and they won't question it. And that made me wonder about the education going on at the academy, because if you're supposed to be teaching these cadets to uphold the values of the Federation Charter,
but
wouldn't
I mean,
you think that they would question something where they're like clearly violating the values that they're being taught to uphold?
But the other thing that they bring up in this episode, you know, I mean, there's a whole big scene where, you know, Admiral Layton, guy with beard. Right. Admiral Layton. Yeah. He's like, you know, hey, Sisko, you know, it's you're my, you know, subordinate and you're supposed to, you know, bring alternatives. But at the end of the day, you're supposed to listen to what I have to say. And, you know, I'm right because I'm higher ranking than you. I mean, I'm sure that that's being drilled into Red Squad's head. And if an admiral comes to them and says, hey, guys, we need you to do, you know, an elite top secret mission, they're not going to care what it is. They're going to be like, oh, yeah, we just hit the big time. You know, sure. I mean, they're not. These are college kids. I was a college kid once and I was really, really stupid.
And if they told you to shoot somebody, you would have totally shot them for an A.
I would have totally shot them for an A.
Yeah.
No, but, you know, I mean, do you think they knew what the, I mean, they were just like, hey, we need you to disable this thing. I'm sure they didn't go into why. They were just like, that sounds cool. We could totally do that.
See, I understand your argument. My thing that is different than that is sort of similar. Starfleet loves to screw with your head. There are tons of tests and examinations and particular hoops you got to go through, and they all involve like messing with your mind and your personality and like what you think you're supposed to be doing. I mean, it's not just the Kobayashi Maru. Apparently, they do it all the time. Like every time they have like a test with Wesley, they're like, "Oh yeah, you got to let somebody
die. There's a dude that's gonna die under a ventilation thing. Yeah. You got to get the other guy out of the toxic white plume of steam." Yeah,
and there's the point where they're like, where the guy comes. On. He's like, I'm gonna grill everybody in your ship, and then you're not gonna pass the test until you tell me to stop. And then there's another one where it's like, Troy, you've got to kill LaForge because that's apparently the assignment now. Everything in Starfleet, is like every step. It's like, here, learn how to make this ship work. Also, here's a test, and the answer is not anywhere in this. It's an entirely different thing. You got to wear your hat backwards.
I like how as time goes on, though, the tests get simpler. And, you know, by the time you get to that future timeline, it's just a taste test of Darjeeling or Earl Grey.
Yes.
Eventually, someone's going to be like, how many lights are there? And you're like, how many lights do you want there to be?
I mean, I think that the real answer is the writers were intentionally keeping it vague because they were getting everything that they needed to out of this episode. But the way that these guys in particular, I think, worked was, you know, yeah, we might all be right. And all that really matters is what the next story requires of them, you know, and they're going to shape it into whatever they want based on, you know, what happened in this episode and what someone else may, you know, bring up and say like, hey, were these guys, you know, this or that? And they're like, I never thought of that. But yeah, they totally are, you know, kind of the Robert Altman thing.
Sure. And you bring up an interesting thing about Starfleet's command structure, too, because Star Trek loves to go to this place. I love, Mike, that you brought up the restaurant meeting between Layton and Sisko. And Star Trek loves to do this thing where it's like, you know, you used to serve under me. And it's like, yes, I did. It was a great time. And you were a great man. But now I'm not so sure. It's like, yeah, but I always respected that because it was your opinion and you had your own thing. And you were like, yeah, you'd stand up to me. But you knew when to stand down. You knew when to tell me I was right. And it's like, yeah, but I'm not doing that anymore. We've seen this like 4 times. And I think most recently to this was the Riker and Admiral Locke from Lost.
Pegasus.
Enterprise
fits episode. Into that continuity.
Wait, what? Enterprise?
Enterprise fits into that episode's continuity. Because he goes to the holodeck and he watches all of Enterprise.
The last episode of Next Generation.
Yeah.
These are the Voyages, which they waited quite a few years to produce.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I guess my point is that like Star Trek loves to do this. And it's when it gets to this point, you already know the Admiral in question is evil. But you just have to have it like hammered into your skull one more time. It's like, I understand. I understand that we need to justify why Sisko has taken this long to avoid the truth that this guy is, you know, evil, as Mike might say. But like,
but going to that it's, word.
Well, I was doing it because of your irritation at it. All so right. It was a little dig, first all episode right. dig. No, I'm glad that we don't see that as often anymore. Even though admirals are still crazy in all the new Star Trek ever, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Leighton is obviously a badmiral. It's something about, you know, you get those bars on your collar and you become a badmiral. But
yeah.
I also was thinking as I'm watching this again, for Into Darkness, they already picked up the whole Section 31 bit from DS9, kind of played that in. But, you know, Leighton here is sort of, in terms of the writing timeline, he's like a proto Admiral Marcus from Into Darkness as well, because he's doing, it's kind of the same thing. It's like his position even is that who's going to protect Earth? And Sisko says, you know, it's going to be you. You're going to protect them. And that's the same position that Marcus takes, that the Federation will fall if he's not there to fight the battle.
Or if you want to go in the opposite direction, he's a, ancestor of Admiral Cartwright, right? I mean, that's something that I've heard a lot of people bring up, you know, this episode in relation to Star Trek VI and the fact that Gene Roddenberry hated that idea of, there being this quote unquote evil element in Starfleet, you know, and here they're bringing it up again, which makes me think that Roddenberry would have hated this episode as well. But I think that's kind of weird. But, you know, I mean, but yeah, it's definitely a thing which occurs numerous times in the continuity.
Yeah, I think he probably would not have liked this element of the story. But for me, when Sisko calls for the state of emergency to be declared, I think it was really important in Star Trek personally, because it was a wake-up call that, you know, this future vision that Star Trek is giving us is wonderful, but the future, it's everything isn't perfect like that, and it doesn't just happen. And once it does exist, it doesn't just exist in perpetuity, you know, because it's there. You know, it's something you have to maintain. And well, there will be, like you say, Cartwright, Leighton, Marcus, there are always going to be these forces within it that will undermine it.
It's kind of interesting that Star Trek occasionally feels the need to remind itself of like the basic tenet of like liberty, that eternal vigilance is part of that. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, oh yeah, we can't ever just go, there it is, we're set, let's go back to business. And every once in a while, you do have to remind yourself that you do have to always be on the lookout for things that will infringe on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's perfectly reasonable to do something like this. I think the fact that Roddenberry was opposed to these types of stories shows like his greatest fault as a storyteller.
He had an ideal, but he didn't know how to question it and have it hold up.
And the idea that, you know, here it's not presented as something which is positive or anything like that, but it's an idea which is presented and then challenged. I mean, I don't see any problem with that. I think
the only problem that I have with this episode is that the counter argument is given much too much strength, because the plot isn't fully expanded. It doesn't actually show all of the permutations of how this works. It really is just sort of like, I'm scared of changelings, let's find them with phasers. It's too simple. And it actually does seem fairly reasonable to do that, considering the situation as it's established.
Right, but then there's that second layer of problem solving, which the elder Sisko explores when he's kind of does a very quick analysis of his son, and he says, this business has got you so twisted around you can't think straight. And it's true, because Sisko is doing some of his trademark waffling there in the kitchen. And the elder Sisko is pointing out a really big truth that I've definitely seen. I mean, personally, I've sat there and not been able to make a decision because I couldn't trust certain people. I was in my personal life, my professional life, whatever. And that really has a crippling impact. And then later on, that's revisited when they have that discussion about Sisko's old girlfriends. When he says, what does he say? He says,
that's your nephew Beaumont moment.
Stop. Yes, exactly. You have to stop brooding and make a decision. And that is something that I think a lot of people need to be told. So there's that this undercurrent of a secondary debate about the merits of contemplative action and just finally acting, you know, finally making a decision and going with it. And I look to those to solve my problems, to kind of fill the holes of the primary storyline in this episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the only problem I have with that is that the counter argument to a lot of liberal points of view is decisiveness.
Oh, sure. And you obviously, yeah, no, without examination, not a lot of action is worthwhile. But yeah. On the flip side, just sitting there and endlessly weighing each course of action is also really, really counterproductive.
Well, Star Trek has to find a delicate balance between like those two forces, because it does have to be extremely effective at getting things done and also making sure that it's not doing anything overly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. It's kind of always going to be fighting with those two impulses.
So Joseph does describe this to Ben as his Nephi-Bomite kind of thing. And that's also how I feel about the Roddenberry's vision of the future from TOS into TNG, especially that when I was a teenager, like Sisko was in that situation, that it really, really appealed to me. And as Sisko had a crush on Nephi, you know, I kind of have a crush on this idea of this perfect future. But then as I get older, you know, that kind of, it goes away. It didn't happen. And then that's why I appreciate the look that they're taking here of, like you say, Max, reminding themselves that it can't all be perfect and you do have to be vigilant. And like you say, Michael, about the difficulty of making a decision in a crippling situation like that as well.
Yeah. Process versus stasis. It's always sort of it's an ongoing battle with entropy, and everything has to constantly be evolving at all times. Otherwise it just dies.
Mm.
Well, let's talk about the central point here, which we've talked about a bit along the way, which is rights in wartime, or what some would have us believe is wartime, I think, because like I feel like the world today, you know, many people, especially over the past decade, the U.S. government in general would have us believe that we're in wartime all the time, which is not necessarily the same as an actual war, but it's a great way to erode rights and civil liberties in the name of security. And I think the big question that we have to ask ourselves today, and which is being asked here as well, is, you know, when do we cross that line between trusting people and being suspicious of people who may be our colleagues or our friends or our family, and what happens to our society when we do that? Because that's ultimately the point that they wanted to make here, was that the changeling threat being hard to pin down, because you never know who the changelings are, where they are. And it's the same with a lot of the threats we face in the world today. You know, I mean, I grew up in the Cold War, where it was very, very obvious who the enemy was. But today it's very nebulous. You know, you can't really latch on, for the most part, to some massive nation state as your enemy. And so you get a lot of paranoia, and you go to these great lengths to protect yourself, when what you're actually doing is you're doing the work for them. And that's what Wolf said here, that there are four changelings on Earth, and whatever it is that they're doing to harm us, we are doing much more to harm ourselves than the changelings are.
Yeah, there's a frustrating aspect to that, because the changeling at the end is like, there's only, what, two, three, four of us on this thing?
Yeah.
And it's like, why did you tell us that? That would have really freaked us out for years. We probably would have continued to tear ourselves apart. If you had just not said anything, you would have allowed this to work.
Right, but it's a really powerful point. It's a more frightening point that he makes, right? It's like, there have only been four of us, and this whole planet is in complete disarray. thanks to, you know, less than a handful of shapeshifters. I mean, I think that's a more powerful message, even not taking into account the fact that as a viewer, I want that. I'm more satisfied by that. But, you know, staying in the universe, I think that's very disconcerting. And any time that Starfleet finds one of those four, the changelings have demonstrated their ability to just put another one right on the planet. It's not hard for them to do, right?
Yeah.
So it's creepy.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that they talked about, I think, in the Deep Space Nine companion or whatever, is that, you know, under the original plan, when this would have been the premiere, they would have had more money and they wanted to initially have more shapeshifters on the planet. I think that that would have been detrimental to the story. You know, the idea that there are only four is one of the things which, I mean, that's like the one moment in this episode where I'm just like, wow, you know, it just like really sort of punches you in the gut. And
so you take their word on that?
I mean, I don't know whether or not you do take your word, but just the idea of it.
Sure, the idea is sound, but while I'm watching, I'm thinking, why would you say that? Why would you say that to your enemy?
Well, sure, that's fine. but I'm just talking about more from a production standpoint, idea that, like, you know, they wanted to have more than four. That's a mistake.
I
think it's just having four strengthens the story, because if you think about it, think about these changelings as being analogous to terrorist attacks. So if you think a big attack like the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center, the March 11th attack on the train system in Spain, these big attacks, they're rare. They're spread out years apart. The likelihood that they're going to happen or that you as an individual will ever be caught up in one is minuscule. But they do happen. I mean, they exist.
Right. They're about invoking terror, not actual body count.
Right. And they throw us into such disarray, even though their numbers are so small. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing here with the changelings. There are only four of them, and yet they have everyone ready to declare martial law within the Federation, or at least on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
What did you guys think about Jarresh Inyo?
Ugh.
As the president, because I didn't think the character worked, and the writers also did not like the way the character turned out. David Livingstone didn't like the way it turned out.
Yeah. I mean, how did he get into office? I understand the Federation is comprised of many, many different species, and some of whom are bound to be like these Grazerites who are, you know, exhibit a quiet strength maybe, but this guy had zero strength. I mean, there was no charisma. There was not even kindness. He was just dead. I can't decide if I don't like the performance more than I don't like the character as written. There's nothing about that character other than his suit that I found worth anything in this episode. I don't know.
Well, and his hat. I think Guinan would have loved to have had his hat.
Guinan would have loved that hat. I don't. Yeah.
I mean, every time I see that guy or, you know, hear his voice or whatever, I can't help but think of him as the crazy guy who wrote the screenplay in Jose Chung's From Outer Space. And, you know, to me, that's just, you know, I mean, I don't see him as the president and I never will. So as soon as he opens his mouth, it's just, no, I'm sorry. He's been typecast just like David Duchovny.
But that was a very smart guy. He told us about Lord Kimboat.
I mean, I guess so.
The underworld orgy. Mm-hmm. He knew what he was talking about.
I guess so. You're right.
Sort of.
Jarresh Inyo's position is basically like, hell no, I won't do it. I won't declare martial law. And then 2 minutes later, I have no choice but to do what you ask.
Right.
Like, that's, wow.
Yeah. I mean, there were no, you know, I some of it, like I say, I still can't tell whether it was the pacing of the way it was cut, the way it was filmed. I don't know, but there were no beats in any of those scenes. There was not even a pause before he would take a full 180 on his position, as he did more than once. It was like, I don't know what happened there. It was just a dog's breakfast.
So this character is an alien that we had never seen before and we've never seen again on screen. He is a Grazerite, coming from the verb to graze. He's supposed to be from a planet where these sentient beings evolved from herbivorous creatures like cows or goats or such. And so they are opposed to confrontation because they're these peaceful creatures that roam the fields and eat grass. And they wanted him to be more
heads.
Well, okay, that's brutal. A good point. That's a good point, because they wanted him to be more like an antelope or something, but they actually, the makeup turned out that he feels more like a cow or something, a very, very peaceful. I'm not trying to be rude. He feels like a very, very peaceful grazing animal. And, you know, he has no drive to him. I cannot believe that this person could have ever been elected president of the Federation. So he just completely
doesn't work. And he didn't even
want the job. He didn't want the job.
When the time comes for a hard decision, not only does he act slowly and ineffectually, but he actively says, I didn't want this job. This sucks.
What? See, that's the kind of guy I want to vote for. Yeah. If he says, I don't want to do this, please don't vote for me, that job looks really hard, I'm going to go, I like this guy.
Absolutely.
I trust
him. He was elected into office by the contrarians.
Yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, but they talk about that in Before Sunset, you know, the people who are.
You get a chance to reference that movie.
It's a great movie, but whatever, sure. You know, but I mean, they say that that's a thing, you know, it's like the people who would really be good at these jobs are the ones who don't have the ambition to pursue them.
Ultimately, we would be really well served if the dude was president.
Right.
But he would hate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that would work out well for us.
He would have loved to have been president of the Zerillians on Enterprise, because they actually grow grass on the bridge of their ship.
Yeah.
So he could just roam around.
See, now that sounds real chill. I'd be into that. That's for the next Star Trek series. Plants, grass, no rugs, no carpeting, just grass.
Well, one thing about that, you know, it seems like the Federation presidents are always some sort of aliens. Whereas, you know, like everyone who you see in Starfleet, every admiral except for they had the bullying in here, you know, they're all humans, you know. I don't know. I think that this story would have been more effective if they had like a human as the president of the Federation, not to be all racist or anything.
But, racist!
I mean, I just
gosh,
think that
would
have
been. You're just like Wesley. Wow. You're like Wesley when those Benzites come on the ship.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I just think that would have been more effective for the story. I mean, every time you go to Vulcan, you see a Vulcan. And I mean, maybe since
I
this
play
is
the race
Federation.
Card.
But I mean, I don't know. I just think that would have been more effective in this particular story.
I think
since
that,
it's all about Earth and Earth being paradise, paradise being lost.
See, I think of that as being part of the exact mechanism that's at play, because I think that people know in the Federation we are all almost entirely humans.
Yeah.
Let's give some lip service to our cosmopolitan nature by electing an alien.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what they did in the 24th century when they elected that Ephrosian Pope. That was very unexpected.
See, this is the problem with this show and listening to this show and everything is, even though I've seen every episode of Star Trek multiple times, sometimes I have no idea what you're talking about, like at all.
Well, sometimes we're just making stuff up, like the Ephrosian Pope, you know?
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's not a real thing.
Okay. I see. I assumed it was from, like, the animated series or something, you know?
But the Ephrosian.
Chris, you're too good at deadpanning. You have to be worse at deadpanning.
But the Ephrosian president was the president in Star Trek VI, you know? And I think the flowing white hair would work really well for a pope.
Yeah.
I guess it would.
Guy, and he was also the helmsman in Star Trek IV. They're coming. Mm-hmm. Here she comes now.
Yeah, who changed his voice every line. That guy?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
That's racist, too.
What? He did. All right.
Okay. So, Jada Shenyo did not work, clearly, as a president.
No.
And I think that almost before I knew that the writers themselves weren't happy with the way that he was portrayed, I felt like, well, they're just trying to write this extremely pacifist president to balance against Leighton, because you have Jarish on the extreme pacifist side, you've got Leighton on the crazy badmiral side, and then you've got Sisko kind of in the middle, giving the point of view that I think most of us feel is probably the one that's closest to reality, which is that we want to uphold the principles, but there are unfortunately times in life where maybe we do have to make concessions, maybe we do have to curb rights and civil liberties. But you have to be careful doing it, because like Leighton says that, you know, Starfleet will take control of Earth temporarily for as long as is needed. But of course, that's how dictatorships begin. And yeah, that's where Leighton would have taken things.
Well, I mean, that's just how it always goes. I mean, that's why there's an aspect of this, which is like, you know, it's easy to say like DS9 was prescient about things, but in a way it was just doing the way all dictatorships come into existence. It's like it goes back to ancient Rome. It's like, oh, we elect a guy just temporarily when we're at war to, you know, do everything we need. And then one time he's like, I'm going to stay. And then we called him Caesar. So like, that's just how it goes every single time. It's always the same system. It's there's a problem. Let's get one guy to solve it. He'll take care of it. He's taking care of it. The problem seems to have gone away now, but he's still doing all that stuff every single time. It always works the exact same way. Mm-hmm. So it seems kind of odd that we have to keep telling stories about it, but apparently we do, because every generation, everyone forgets it.
Everyone forgets it. Yeah. Not even every generation. It's like every 6 years, everyone forgets it, it seems like.
That's true. When are you going to become tyrannical, Chris?
It's coming. It's soon. I'm 5 years into my 6-year cycle. So.
Okay. All right.
I knew that docile exterior couldn't last forever.
They got me started with the Blu-ray release of Into Darkness. That was the first seeds of it.
Oh, makes you want to smash a spaceship.
Okay, well, we have passed an hour in our discussion here of Homefront Paradise Lost, so I think we've hit all the major points of the story. Let's wrap up with our final thoughts. How about Mike? What are your final thoughts on the story?
Well, I guess, you know, when I was in Vegas, I got to see Ira Steven Bear talk, which was like definitely the highlight of the convention for me. And, you know, people kept on bringing up, you know, Far Beyond the Stars and Trials and Tribulations. And he was like, yeah, those are really good episodes. But what I really like is when people say that their favorite episode is, you know, one of the regular episodes, you know, where it's just Deep Space Nine being the best Deep Space Nine it can be. And to me, that's kind of what, this two-parter is for me. You know, this is one of my favorite episodes of the series. I think it's
take that, Major Kira.
There you go. I think it's doing a really good job with its, you know, social commentary and a lot of the character stuff. I think is really good too. And for that reason, it's one of my all-time favorite episodes of the series.
And what's your rating? Your ready room style rating?
Oh, I guess it would be five Red Squadron cadets. Does that Red Squad cadets? Does that work?
Okay.
I don't know. See, I'm not good at this stuff. I'm really not good at this stuff.
No, that works. That's a good rating. That's solid. I like that.
All right.
That's a good rating. Okay. Yeah. How about you, Max?
I enjoy watching these episodes, but this is definitely in that point of Deep Space Nine where I'm like getting irritated because I know how good it's going to get. And I'm just really anxious for it to get to that point. And this part of the series is just not quite there yet. So I enjoy it, but it's not as impeccable as I want it to be. And the political problems of the poorly thought out argument leading to the antithetical argument being much more reasonable is a real problem for me. So I'm only going to give it 2 Grazerites and 1 Brian Grazer.
Excellent. A combo rating. Mm-hmm. How about you, Michael?
As usual, Max, I think I really agree with your points that the story is flawed in a lot of like pretty big ways. But as usual, I am looking at the show not only through the rose-tinted glasses of nostalgia and longing for my lost childhood, but also from the ground level and not the 10,000-foot view. So I really appreciate some of the details. I appreciate that this episode shows us life on Earth for an extended period, for one of the only times that Star Trek does that. I'm really glad we get to just kind of hang out in various parts of Starfleet Academy and see what that culture is like. We get to see absurd things like Odo becoming a seagull and Chief O'Brien as a changeling, Cole Meany just having a ball there. And we get to see what life is like when you can beam from San Francisco to New Orleans for dinner with your dad and your son and cool stuff like that. So, you know, all that stuff works together for me to also, like Mike, appreciate these two episodes as some of my favorite DS9, even though it is, as you say, Max, not near as good overall as the series will get. So all that being said, I would probably give it 7 out of 10 vials of changeling blood.
Wow, excellent. Yeah, I agree with you guys. It's like you, Michael. It's one of my favorite DS9 stories, although Max, I completely see your point about the flaws in the story. It's one of those stories where I wish, especially now, even more so than at the time that it aired, I wish that they could flesh the story out more. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's a story where if they could have done it at the beginning of the season, like they did the Circle trilogy at the start of season 2, and used 3 episodes to tell the story and put the money into it and really, really delved more deeply into the nuts and bolts of the story, it would have been even better. But it addresses an important issue and a timeless issue that we have to face in society. And that, like we said, unfortunately, it seems that we as a society need to be reminded of this very frequently. And so I think it does that very well. It does what I think Star Trek should do and should be talking about in a way that wasn't done as often in the past because of this anti-conflict approach to Star Trek. So I like it very much. We didn't mention 247 references in this episode. I don't know if you noticed the transport tube outside of the Starfleet headquarters is divided into section 47 and 48 that we're passing by. And also, as Odo and Sisko are going over all the records in the office there, they are using code Leighton 1 Omega 47 to hack into the system. So a couple of sneaky ones there. I always like to just
right.
So, but I like this episode very much. And, you know, they talk a lot about vampires in here too. So maybe it's kind of like a pre-Twilight thing. If someone needs a hook, you know, to get in there and watch it.
Oh, God.
Daddy Sisko calls the Starfleet officers vampires, of course, for sucking blood.
Yeah. Yeah.
So good political intrigue within Starfleet, which I always love. So I'm going to give this episode 8 alligators suspended from the ceiling.
Out of how many suspended alligators?
It's usually left to your imagination.
Oh, mystery box full of alligators.
Yeah, mystery box full of alligators, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so figure that out. Chomp on that.
Before we finish, this episode does have the first part of this does have the episode that does have the Worf saying that the Klingon gods were all killed by Klingon warriors, which is one of my favorite things in the history of all Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is totally, totally awesome. And I want that to be the next Star Trek movie.
Well, the
Clash of the Titans, but they're all Klingons.
Yeah. Well, the because they do that reading in, you are quarterly invited, right? Where they talk about the story of the Klingon heart and how they killed the...
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually used that reading for our wedding.
Really?
Yeah, that was our reading.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
We're nerds.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I know.
It's really good that you're married. Because after you do that, you're never getting another chick after that.
I know.
It's never going to happen.
I know.
Well, it's good that you locked it down.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that line too, Max, and even what he says after that even more. He says they were more trouble than they were worth.
Yeah.
And
totally right.
Classic Star Trek commentary on that. But also doing that in DS9 worked a lot better than if Worf had said that on The Next Generation because of DS9's very spiritual focused storyline with the Bajorans. And there is a great contrast bringing Worf on the show between Kira and Worf when it comes to spirituality.
Yeah,
there would have been really no place for it in Next Generation. No place.
Well, he could have said it, but it wouldn't have had any impact on you, right?
Yeah. So
it could have been theoretically a funny line if Data made a face.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh, this episode also has, you know, on the Next Generation, at least in Generations, they're finishing that joke that they supposedly told on the Encounter to Farpoint mission, where he says, you know, you have to leave, but the Ferengi in the gorilla suit.
The gorilla suit has to go.
And we have one here where Quark is telling the joke, and he's trailing at the end, and he says, and then the Andorian says, that's not my antenna. Why didn't that ever catch on, like the Ferengi in the gorilla suit with fans?
Because it's a very blue joke.
Oh, God.
Come on, that was gold. That was gold. I get another jacket just for that.
Okay, all right.
Bravo. Oh, I just got it.
Yeah, yeah. And you may not know it, Max, but that is, I believe, the second Ready Room in a row with a blue joke.
Really?
About Boleans and Andorians, yeah.
Sweet.
Awesome.
New catchphrase.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us today, guys. I really appreciate it. And so far, we have managed to make it through the typhoon without losing power. I have not had to get out my vacuum cleaner window-saving attachment. So, Mike and Max, before we go, tell everyone where they can find you guys, about your other shows and such.
Well, you can find our other show on Trek FM called Commentary Trek Stars. Right now, we just started up a series on Ron Moore as a showrunner. And on Friday, Chris will be on the show to talk about Roswell.
Sorry about that.
And we also have another show called Commentary Track Stars over on commentarytrackstars.com, where we do audio commentaries for one more week before moving on to other things. And our last commentary will be on
the internet
Sunday.
Oh, the day. Yeah, that makes more sense.
So look out for that too.
You're doing a commentary on the internet?
No, it'll be available on the internet.
It'll be hosted on the World Wide Web. You just point your, your Netscape navigator to a certain
on
address.
Computers.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks again, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, that was an awesome time revisiting this episode of DS9, which I have not thought of in a while, and which I, as I said in the wrap-up of the feature there, just really, really enjoyed revisiting that little fragment of my youth and the youth of DS9 as well.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. This is, like I said, one of my favorite DS9 episodes, and it was interesting to hear Max's point of view, because I think because I really liked the episode a lot, I've kind of focused on the message of civil liberties and how do we react to threats, and didn't really think too much about the simplistic elements of the plot, but he had a good point there. So it's nice to, learn something new and get a new perspective on the episode, which is, of course, what the Ready Room is all about.
Agreed.
So as much fun as this was, Michael, you know, it's not the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here are some other things that you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Orb.
Aliens of Deep Space Nine.
That's a really good question. I honestly never even thought to question the Vorta's idea of their own existence and whether or not it was, you know, just a story.
The Ready Room.
A matter of honor.
Riker is the perfect person to go on this exchange because he has that confidence to go toe-to-toe with a Klingon to make his presence known and to get that authority right away.
To the journey!
The Malon.
I just loved how how immediately when the Malon came on, the main guy came on the view screen, he's like, I use 6 spatial charges. I expect to be compensated. Like, it wasn't even like, hey, you okay? Commentary, Trek Stars.
Ronald D. Moore.
I'm saying that I don't know who the Ringo of Deep Space Nine is, but it wasn't Ron Moore, because Ron Moore has got to be the Paul McCartney.
Warp 5.
The Sphere Builders.
And it is a good concept. I think it, and obviously the reasons it was introduced were more because of the studio and wanting that looking forward perspective, you know, getting ahead of the 24th century.
Trek News and Views.
Darmok.
I guess I've just bought a book and I say, what on? You know, which mean, what on? You know, Kindle or? No, I went to a bookshop. Went to a bookshop?
Literary Treks.
Assignment Earth Comics.
I kind of liked it in that it picks up from Assignment Earth, the Star Trek episode, where we find out that Gary Seven has been sent there to find out why the two agents who were supposed to be stopping that missile launch can't do it. What happened to them?
And introducing our new next generation show, Earl Grey.
My garage turned into a holodeck with some crepe paper and a nice grid pattern. I just could not get enough of it. That was Halloween. That was everything. And my parents very indulgingly gave me many Playmates toys because those things were awesome.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week. In fact, we have two shows for you many days. And now with our new TNG show out, you can check that out as well. So go over to iTunes and look up Earl Grey and get your cup of Next Generation every week with Darren, Daniel, and Philip. And you'll find all of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. Aren't you glad they're on Xbox now, Michael? You used to ask me about that quite often.
I did ask you about that, and I've actually checked recently, and I think I'm not sure if all the shows are on there. Is everyone on the Windows Phone podcast
they're
store?
They're supposed to be, because I actually did work with Microsoft to make sure everything is there.
Okay, I will go back and recheck that on my Lumia 1020, because I was trying to tune into the Orb a few weeks ago, and I don't think I could find it, but maybe it's on there now. I hope it is.
Maybe it was cloaked, probably.
It was probably cloaked. It's exactly
the Lakota
right.
was coming to try to, you know, knock them off the air, and they needed to cloak, and we managed to do it before we were attacked this time, so
right.
that's where it was.
Right.
But yeah, you should be able to find the shows on Xbox as well as Zune. Some people do use those as well. I know many people think it's strange that we mention Zune, but they're out there. And you can also download from the website. You can download the files, you know, if you have a BlackBerry and you want to throw the files on there. You can even stream from the website. So go check out all the shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. Now, Michael, usually we just jump into how to contact us, but we did have one piece of feedback this week that I wanted to address on the show, because this actually ties into something that I've been thinking about a little bit. And Daniel Hadlin from California said, "Great show, guys. I recently discovered Trek FM from a flyer at the Las Vegas convention." So I'm glad to hear that those worked and someone found the show that way. "It's been the most awesome thing ever. I have a really long commute to work, and I don't know how I'd make it through each week without these top-notch shows. The Ready Room in particular, I was thinking it would be great if sometime you did a few episodes on some material from the animated series. I know it isn't quite a fully fledged Star Trek show, but it certainly had its high points, such as Yesteryear, The Slaver Weapon, and introduced a good bit of canon that was later picked up in the live-action shows." And that's a great point, Daniel.
It's a solid point, right?
Michael, I wanted to ask you, this is an idea, because other people have asked about this, and I can't see us at Trek FM ever doing a show that's dedicated exclusively to the animated series, the way that we have Earl Grey and The Orb and To the Journey and Warp 5, but I have thought about doing a limited run series for the animated series, where we talk about it for X number of episodes, and then we retire the show. Would you be interested in that? I mean, I'm wondering what our listeners think about that, if that's something people are interested in or not.
That's a solid question. You know, the thing is, as vast as Star Trek is in terms of aired episodes and films and books and things, it is finite, right? It's only growing at a very slow rate these days, as we talked about back in the news segment. And you do want to talk about it all. You want to cover it all. And there is a small but fierce contingent of folks who really like the animated series. And I think that a small venture into that would be very compelling, you know, and I think it would serve that fan base. And Daniel makes a good point that some of the stuff survived from, you know, it graduated, say, from the animated series into the real, the canon. I'm not sure, you know, I can only speak as a hypothetical listener. But I would have to say that would give me a reason to tune into a couple of the animated series episodes, because I've had them sitting on my DVD shelf for about 3 or 4 years now, and I think I've only watched like one of them.
Yeah, I have them sitting over there as well.
Yeah, so I think that's something to consider.
Yeah, well, everyone who's listening, let us know what you think. You know, send us a message through email, hit us up on Twitter, wherever. Just tell us if you'd be interested in hearing more about the animated series, because it is something that we have been thinking about for a while internally. Haven't really decided yet how we're going to handle that, but we do want to cover it. And Daniel, thank you for your message, and I'm really glad that our shows are helping you get through that long commute. I know what that's like. I used to commute 4.5 hours round trip every day to get to work back some years ago. So I know, and that was in the days before podcasts or iPods or any of that stuff. So I did a lot of reading back then. So we're glad that's helping you. And for everyone else, if you'd like to send us a message, there are a number of ways you can do it. You can go to the website, go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that'll come to us by email. That's also how you can send us your questions from the fleet for the segment that we are starting to do during news, where we just answer your Star Trek questions and share our thoughts on those. That same form has an option to who should you direct the message to. You can choose questions from the fleet there, and that'll come to us as well. So please send us your questions about Star Trek. Also on Twitter, you'll find us under username TrekFM. And on Facebook, you'll find us at facebook.com/TrekFM. And you can even send us a voicemail from the website if you click the tab on the right-hand side of any page. A box will appear. You can record a message using your webcam's microphone and upload that to us as an MP3 file. So send us a message. Let us know what you think about the show. Send us your questions about Star Trek. We'd love to hear from you. And again, thanks for your message, Daniel. And Michael, what if people want to talk to you? Talk to Captain Two Phones, whether it's about Star Trek or about smartphones or feature phones or, you know, Star Trek bridge battle games.
Yeah.
Where can they find you?
If people want to talk to me about any of those things, they can indeed hail the captain. I am on Twitter at Captain Two Phones. I'm on Instagram under the same handle, and basically anywhere social on the web that handles such as those are found. Yeah, I talk a lot about mobile technology. I talk an awful lot about Star Trek as well. And if you unfollow me 2 days after following me, I will not hold it against you because I talk too much about everything.
I think some people probably unfollowed me yesterday as I tweeted away during the
definitely live blogging that football game. I was like, man, my feed is crazy right now, and it's fine because my feed was moving at a million miles an hour anyway because everyone was doing that, Chris. It wasn't just you. Everyone was tweeting about football.
So if you like football and you want to follow along next time the games are going next weekend, you can find me at C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. Although when the football games are going, I do tweet away about what's happening. Most of the week, though, I'm tweeting more about Star Trek or Japan, you know, design, things like that. Usually not as much about football. So it's a good mix, I think.
It is. But you've got a nice, diverse Twitter feed going there.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. So you can check all that stuff out. And then elsewhere on the network, besides the show, you'll find me on Sundays with Matthew Rushing doing Literary Treks, where we talk about Star Trek books and comics and interview authors. On a Monday, we do The Orb, which is all about Deep Space Nine. And then on Fridays, I'm with Kate Walsh on Warp 5, where we talk just about Star Trek Enterprise. And I also have my occasional interview show called Matterstream, where I interview scientists and writers and actors and different people who are involved in areas outside of Star Trek, but they have somewhat of a loose connection to Star Trek. So you can check that out as well. And lastly, Michael, before we let everyone go, we would like to ask you to support our sponsor for this week's show, and that is Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website, portfolio, online store, or in the case of Michael, that website where he pairs up Star Trek characters with smartphone technology.
With the smartphones they would use. I think this idea has legs. I think, and I wouldn't use any other provider to build it.
You shouldn't. And again, you can do that starting at just $8 a month, Michael. But first, you can try it free for 14 days. And then when you sign up, use offer code TREK9 to get 10% off your lifetime purchase. Choose the annual plan and get that free custom domain registration. And you can get it all by going to squarespace.com. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of Trek FM and the Ready Room. And also, if you would personally like to support what we're doing here at Trek FM, you can support our programming by visiting trek.fm/donate. We have 8 alien-themed badges and art prints there that are custom illustration by Toba Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. And you can mix and match badges and art prints. Choose what you want. We have various levels of donations that you can make. And your contributions help us cover the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the Ready Room and all the rest of our programming to you every week. So we really appreciate your support on that. And you can find all that again at trek.fm/donate. Well, Michael, I've got to go. I'm going to head back over to the academy and hang out with Red Squad for the blackout party. Because those kids really know how to throw a bash.
Oh, absolutely. Enjoy your time over there, Chris. And I think it's time to stick a pair of Admiral's bars in it. Because the Ready Room is done.